Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the brinkmanship between the U.S. and Iran as the U.S. engages in economic warfare against the theocratic regime to which Iran's foreign minister claims the Iranians have a right to respond, saying, "We believe this escalation by the United States is unacceptable and uncalled for. We have exercised maximum restraint." Suzanne Maloney, a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who served as a policy advisor at the State Department and is the author of Iran's Political Economy Since the Revolution, joins us to discuss President Trump's remarks to the acting Secretary of Defense during Wednesday's briefing in the Situation Room that he did not want to go to war with Iran. We'll assess whether the hawkish efforts by John Bolton have been checked and if the Iranians are likely to pick up on Trump's offer to call him on the phone and make a deal. We'll also look into Iran's use of proxies to retaliate against any attack on them, whether it be Hezbollah unleashed on Israel or the Houthis unleashed against Saudi Arabia. And since Iran has a powerful presence and influence in Iraq, the 5,000 U.S. troops in that country would be in harm's way if any military clash between the U.S. and Iran were to erupt in this incendiary standoff currently underway in that volatile neighborhood. Then we'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept, about his latest article, "Did Donald Trump's Grip on the Justice Department Sabotage Robert Mueller's Investigation?" With many pundits buying into the idea that Rod Rosenstein was protecting Mueller from Trump, that myth has surely been shattered by Rosenstein's craven assurance to Trump that he would, quote, land the plane. And James Comey's recent description of Rosenstein as a weak man clinging to his job. We'll speculate whether we'll find out what went on behind the scenes between Mueller and Barr in the weeks before Barr's memo came out, and what we will find out if and when Mueller testifies in public. Then finally, we'll assess the impact of Trump's executive order that effectively bars U.S. companies from using telecom equipment manufactured by China's Huawei, which is expected to impact American companies manufacturing components for Huawei and slow down the introduction of 5G networks worldwide. Gordon Chang, a writer and international policy analyst and author of The Coming Collapse of China, joins us to discuss what he considers a bold but necessary move to stop China's decades-long theft of intellectual property and serial violations of agreements not to engage in cyber attacks. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Suzanne Maloney, who's a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, the political economy of the Persian Gulf, and Middle East energy policy, a former United States State Department policy advisor, and her latest book is Iran's Political Economy Since the Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Suzanne Maloney.
Thank you.
And apparently, President Trump has told his acting Secretary of Defense that he doesn't want a war with Iran. But on the other hand, Iran's foreign minister, who's in Japan, said that they have the right to retaliate. Quoting Zarif, "We believe that escalation by the United States is unacceptable and uncalled for. We have exercised maximum restraint." And he went on to say a multilateral deal cannot be treated unilaterally. So would it be fair to say that the U.S. is conducting economic warfare against Iran as we speak?
Well, I think the maximum pressure strategy that the Trump administration has been pursuing, particularly since the past year when President Trump exited the United States from the Iran nuclear deal, has amounted to economic warfare. There have been sanctions in place that target various elements of the Iranian economy, and they're typically financial measures, and so one of the most wide-reaching impacts of those measures is that it essentially cuts Iran off from the international financial system, makes it very difficult to conduct any kind of transactions through licit banking mechanisms. There have been new sanctions announced even within the past month. The Trump administration has declined to grant waivers to continue Iranian exports of oil. That means that any country that buys Iranian oil exports could face sanctions. And what we've seen to date is that most countries are unwilling to take that risk. The administration's also announced sanctions against Iran's steel and other metals industries in an attempt, I think, to create dissatisfaction within the population, which has already been heavily impacted by the broader effects of the sanctions. So, it's not inaccurate to suggest that sanctions can be a tool of warfare and that these measures are very far-reaching and quite catastrophic for Iran's economy.
So there's been some suggestions that the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, is trying to goad Iran into something reckless. The IRGC, of course, the Revolutionary Guards Corps, have those speedboats, and apparently some overheads suggested that they were loading missiles onto speedboats. But it does at times feel like we have maybe two or three foreign policies with Bolton, Pompeo, and Trump not necessarily always being on the same page. Does it appear to you, Suzanne Maloney, that the president has reined in Bolton?
Well, I'm a bit cautious about personalizing all of this around John Bolton. He's certainly had a long track record of advocating for the toughest types of policies against Iran. He's called in the past for both regime change and for military strikes against Iran. And so we should have no illusions about where he stands. But this is the president's policy. He's reaffirmed it himself. He campaigned long before John Bolton was part of his inner circle on the idea of renegotiating the Iran nuclear deal. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing at this stage is this implementation of a strategy which suits both the interests of someone who might want a new nuclear deal, as well as the interests of someone who might prefer to see Iran economically collapsed or even provoked into some kind of a military confrontation. Maximum pressure can apply either way. The test now is exactly how Trump proceeds from here. Does he, in fact, try to make good on his own appeals to engage in direct diplomacy with Iran? Is he primarily focused on getting a new deal? Or will he simply continue this policy of pressure, which very well could lead over time to additional provocations on each side and an escalatory spiral that could spin out of control?
So do you think the Iranians are likely to pick up on Trump's offer to pick up the phone and call him?
I do think there's some receptivity on the part of the Iranians to testing the waters. The foreign minister, Javad Zarif, was in New York very recently. He made the rounds of all of the television news shows, including Fox News, I think with an intended audience of one in the White House. He also reached out across the U.S. political spectrum to try to make the Iranians' case and dangled the idea of a prisoner swap that might involve freeing the Americans and other foreign nationals who have been picked up as pawns, innocents detained in some cases for several years, essentially as hostages by the Iranian regime. And I think that that was seen as a kind of overture from Iran, as an opportunity for possibly setting the stage for some broader negotiation. It's not clear that the administration is ready to move in that arena, but I do think that where you have a constituency on each side that has some interest in negotiating, that and there is a preference, I think, even in among hardliners in both bureaucracies, to avoid an all-out war. I do think that we will see some kind of diplomacy play out over the course of the next few months.
And again, I'm speaking with Suzanne Maloney, who's a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, the political economy of the Persian Gulf, and Middle East energy policy, a former United States State Department policy advisor. Her latest book is Iran's Political Economy Since the Revolution. So if the president is trying to, you know, offer an olive branch here and get the Iranians to call him, I don't know exactly why he can't call them, but either way, we've discussed that. But don't you think, though, that President Trump doesn't want the price of oil to spike before the election? Wouldn't that be, I mean, he's really focused on getting reelected, isn't he?
Surely. And I think it goes well beyond the price of oil, which would obviously have a very negative impact on his prospects for reelection. But Trump has campaigned quite a bit around the idea of extricating the United States from the protracted and very costly military conflicts that prior administrations either initiated or stumbled into and found themselves in several cases quite stuck. So this has been a major element. He's talked an awful lot about it over the years, and I think it reflects a genuine preference on his side. So on that basis alone, I think that he is seeking to avoid any kind of direct military conflict. And I take some, I guess, some optimism from the fact that the Iranians have been relatively calibrated in the way that they have responded to American pressure. For the past year, they've continued to abide by their obligations under the nuclear deal, despite the fact that the U.S. walked away and began reimposing all the sanctions that had been waived as part of that deal. Even last week, when they announced some measures to begin to walk back some of that compliance, they did so in probably the least damaging, the most easily reversible dimensions of their nuclear restrictions possible. And I think the same thing can be said of the acts of sabotage that we've seen over the course of the past week, which may have precipitated some of the warnings from the United States and the movement of a battle carrier group into the Persian Gulf ahead of schedule. There were attacks on several oil vessels at the Emirati port of Fujairah, and there was some sabotage attacks on pumping stations on a Saudi pipeline. These were very relatively minor, not terribly devastating military strikes by unconventional forces. We don't know for sure that they've been attributed to Iran, but if in fact the Iranians were behind them, they were trying to send a message, but they were trying to do so in a way that did not in fact provoke further escalation by the United States.
Well, isn't that Iran's sort of MO in terms of foreign policy? If Israel were to attack Iran, Iran would retaliate through its proxy, Hezbollah. And I'm assuming that the Houthis in Yemen would also fulfill that role. And by sending a drone to blow up a Saudi pipeline, they're just sort of indicating what more could come, right? I mean, isn't that, at what point do you think the gloves would come completely off and the U.S. and Iran would be confronting each other openly and not through proxies or through provocations?
I am still hopeful that we can turn back from the brink and avoid an open confrontation between Washington and Tehran. I think that, you know, should the administration continue on this current path of really the most severe economic pressure imaginable on a country, we are likely to see an escalation on the part of the Iranians, because they will have, I think, even domestic requirements to sort of demonstrate that there's a price to be paid on the part of the international community. So, you know, we are in a bit of a predicament. Both sides need to find a way out of the impasse that they're in. The president needs to be able to avoid a military conflict or anything that would spike the price of oil. The Iranians need some economic relief simply to avoid the total collapse of their economy. I think there's a way to create a platform for a negotiation between the two sides, which probably won't solve or come anywhere close to solving it, all the differences between them, but could at least avert a catastrophic military engagement.
So just to follow on Iran's ability to retaliate via proxies, there are 5,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, and there are lots of Iranian militias, and many analysts think that the only winner of the Iraq war was Iran. So what's your sense of, if there was any serious confrontation between the U.S. and Iran, how vulnerable would our troops be in Iraq?
Well, I think Iraq is the most obvious place for the Iranians to try to strike back. They have an enormous amount of influence and capacity there. And they're very dug in terms of their relationship with the government and with the militias that have in many ways become part of the official security forces. But again, I think so far what we've seen is an effort on the part of the Iranians to avoid precipitating the wider conflict. They're trying to show that there's some vulnerability, and they're trying to, I think, make good on some of the promises that they have made over the years, that if they can't export their oil, that others in the region will find their own oil export capacity jeopardized as well. So my guess is we'll see more of the same, more efforts to target oil-related infrastructure because it helps the Iranians' bottom line in terms of raising the price for whatever barrels they're able to get to market. And it also hurts the president in terms of his political vulnerabilities for 2020. And the Iranians, part of their strategy has been to try to wait out this administration, so anything that they could do to tip the balance and make it a more uphill climb to see a second Trump term, I think would work to their benefit.
So what role do you think Russia's playing here? Because President Trump recently had an hour and a half conversation with Putin on the phone, and we don't know what was said. We don't even know what was said in face-to-face meetings that they've had. There are no note takers and no readouts. But subsequent to that, Pompeo met with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Sochi just recently, and they discussed Iran. At least that's what we're told. I'm sort of somewhat skeptical of the relationship between Trump and Putin. It's not clear what that relationship is. And the Mueller report, which did look into it, has actually been bottled up by the Trump administration. They're not even releasing the full report, in spite of the fact that the president said it exonerates him. So there's reason to be suspect of the nature of Trump's and Putin's relationship. But that said, what do you think the Russians' attitude is, or advice for that matter? I mean, just to be cynical, if there were a shutdown of the Gulf and things got out of hand, Russia would be a big winner if the price of oil goes up.
Well, I think, you know, when you think about the rising tensions in the region, it's clear that there are very few winners from the current predicament and certainly from any escalation. The only one that really comes to mind is the Russians. They do stand to benefit from anything that creates more backlash against the United States across the region, from anything that wards off any possibility of an improvement in the relationship between Tehran and Washington, which of course seemed on the horizon a couple of years ago, and anything that impacts the price of oil in an upward direction and potentially even creates real supply disruptions coming out of the Gulf would be a major economic benefit for the Russians. So I think they're simply sitting back and watching this play out to their advantage, with one possible caveat that they would be quite concerned about anything that would appear to put the Iranian nuclear program back on a very fast track, or that might, in fact, produce a wave of Islamist-inspired terrorism, because that has been a longstanding concern of theirs.
Well, if Iran were to go nuclear, Saudi Arabia would do it quickly, right? And they might even buy one from Pakistan. At least that's been suggested.
I think the Saudis have a much longer path. The Iranians, in fact, have a pretty well-established scientific capability. They have, in fact, an industrial-scale nuclear program, which, for the most part, has been under lock and key as a result of the nuclear deal. But they can certainly back away from some of the restrictions they agreed to under the deal and begin ramping back up their program in fairly short order. It would be, I think, a longer-term prospect for the Saudis unless they could get a kind of implicit promise from the Pakistanis of either delivering some kind of a weapon or giving them access to one. I think, you know, for the most part, that has been something that the Pakistanis to date, we believe, have failed to do because of a variety of domestic concerns. And it would create enormous uncertainty and anxiety within the U.S. national security establishment if, in fact, there were signals that this was underway.
Well, just in closing, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates once remarked that the Saudis and the Israelis would like to fight the Iranians to the last American. Is there any wag the dog scenario going on here? What kind of pressure is Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman putting on Trump that might be countervailing to his caution, which we've mentioned earlier, about not wanting the price of oil to go up and offering the Iranians the olive branch of picking up the phone and calling him?
I don't see a conspiracy here. I do think that, you know, many of America's regional partners, and particularly the governments that the Trump administration has been closest to in the region, have very strong views on Iran and have, in fact, been supportive and even encouraging of the Trump administration's efforts to put very severe pressure on the Iranians. But what you see, at least in formal reporting over the course of the past week or two, is a sense of preference on the part of many in Israel, including in the security establishment, as well as many in the Gulf. The foreign minister of the United Arab Emirates, among others, recently said that they'd prefer to see de-escalation. So I think that there is a, you know, often a lot of tough rhetoric, but traditionally we have seen that, in fact, the Gulf in particular, and at least some within Israel, would prefer see Iran as a problem to be managed, not as one that has a quick military solution.
Well, Suzanne Maloney, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Suzanne Maloney, who's a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, the political economy of the Persian Gulf, and Middle East energy policy, a former United States State Department policy advisor. Her latest book is Iran's Political Economy Since the Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break and back speculating what went on behind the scenes between Mueller and Barr in the weeks before Barr's memo came out. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of the New York Times bestseller State of War. In 2006, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept, Did Donald Trump's Grip on the Justice Department Sabotage Robert Mueller's Investigation? Welcome to Background Briefing, James Risen.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks. And, of course, the Attorney General, William Barr, just said he has no problem with Bob, meaning Robert Mueller, testifying. But, of course, prior to that, President Trump tweeted out, Bob Mueller should not testify, no redos for the Dems. So, whose word would you take, James, the president's or Barr's?
Well, either way, it doesn't really matter, because I think the damage has been done to Mueller and to the investigation. I think what I wrote in my column basically was that I think 2 years of pressure from Trump, both on individual leaders of the Justice Department and generally on the system, the result was a very narrow and tentative and kind of hesitant report from Mueller. I think his final report showed, at least indirectly, that he succumbed to some of the pressure that Trump was imposing, both on him and on the Attorney General at the time, Jeff Sessions, and on Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, who was in charge of supervising his investigation. You know, Trump continually said, I want to fire Sessions, I want to fire Rosenstein, I want to fire Mueller. This is all a hoax, I want to get it over with. And it's, it's just not plausible to assume that that had no effect. And I think if you read the Mueller report, you see the effect, which is a rushed job. Mueller narrowed his focus to in the volume one, where he recounts all these Russian contacts with the Trump circle. He has decided that he will not investigate any of those contacts unless he can specifically tie it to the GRU's cyber offensive against the DNC and against Hillary Clinton. So we have the result is, in many cases, many instances, he says, I basically admits he didn't get to the bottom of all these contacts and why the Russians kept contacting the Trump campaign. And then with the obstruction of justice in the second volume, he recounts countless instances of obvious obstruction and then says, well, since there's a Justice Department legal opinion saying he can't indict a sitting president, I'm not going to come to any conclusion. And I believe that all of that shows that he felt under enormous pressure to finish quickly and stick to a narrow mandate, which, if you remember, is very different from past special prosecutors like Lawrence Walsh in Iran-Contra or Ken Starr in Whitewater. Ken Starr obviously started with Whitewater and ended up with Monica Lewinsky. And Lawrence Walsh went on for years trying to figure out Ronald Reagan's role in Iran-Contra. So I think it shows that the pressure from Trump had an effect.
Well, it seems that in many ways the punditry, and particularly on the liberal side, were a little delusional in believing all along that Rod Rosenstein was protecting Mueller and going to the mat for him. And we only recently learned about his conversation with Trump where he promised to land the plane. And that was months before. So what does that mean? I mean, isn't it pretty obvious?
I think when you do investigative reporting, you're always just seeing a small portion of what's going on, even when you get a good scoop. I know that from my own experience, and you can tell it happened with, the various reporters who were trying to break pieces during the Mueller investigation. And so you get little pieces, glimpses of what's going on, but you can never really, in real time, know the full narrative of what's happening with people who aren't, who are involved in something secret like this. And so I think, the story that came out last year saying that Rosenstein was willing to wear and suggested wearing a wire or discussed it with McCabe, the acting FBI director, deputy director, was just one little instance that probably got overinterpreted. So I think we now see that Rosenstein is something that we didn't expect.
Well, the criticism of Rosenstein by James Comey certainly got under Rosenstein's skin, and essentially what Comey was saying was that he's a weak guy, that he folded. I mean, does seem to be the case.
It's interesting because if you read in Comey's book, he says something very similar. He says he was a survivor. Mm-hmm. And then his recent column was even more direct. So I think what you had was a Justice Department that was under siege from Trump, and Mueller, I think, probably felt like just completing the report would be a victory, And so I think we ended up with I find it a very unsatisfying report that documents a lot of contacts between the Russians and the Trump organization and Trump campaign, but doesn't get to the bottom of them. and then documents a lot of instances of obstruction of justice, and decides not to decide whether that violates, whether that amounts to obstruction of justice.
Right, and subsequent to that, 800 former federal prosecutors all said in a letter that if a regular civilian had done what Trump did, he'd already be in jail.
Right, and, you know, the fact that the Justice Department legal opinion saying you can't indict a sitting president, that was a well-known and well-documented issue throughout the entire investigation. And there were many, many experts who said, pointed out, this is a guideline, it's not a law. And if he wants to go against this guideline, Mueller could do so. And so, but he never did. And I think he was very reluctant to push the boundaries of his investigation.
And again, I'm speaking with James Risen, a senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of The New York Times bestseller State of War. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept, Did Donald Trump's Grip on the Justice Department Sabotage Robert Mueller's Investigation? But just on the point you were making then, James Risen, we don't know what went on in that month between, the month prior to the release, the four-page memo from Barr that was able to frame it in a very sympathetic way for Trump and essentially set the narrative. My understanding is that enormous number of the population just have accepted Trump's version and Barr's version of things. And I don't know whether that explains why CNN, for example, has lost its ratings to Fox just of late since the Mueller, and it's been pegged from the time the Mueller report came out. So you may be able to make a case that too many people were too invested in it, or at least appeared to be too invested in it. But, you know, we still haven't seen the report, but Trump's bottled it up. The full report is not available to the Congress or the public. So for a man who says he's exonerated, he's behaving in a rather odd way, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Well, as I said, I think Mueller has left a lot of questions unanswered. And I think that what you see is a report, you know, that you just have to go through the whole section on contacts between the Russians and the Trump campaign, and none of them are explained. I mean, Donald Trump Jr. refused to cooperate with Mueller, refused an interview. Natalia Veselinskaya, the Russian lawyer who met with Trump Jr. and Manafort and Jared Kushner at the Trump Tower in June 2016, was in Russia and was not available to be interviewed by Mueller. And so Mueller basically shrugs and says, well, I can't really get to the bottom of what this was all about. And then he says it was possible that this was a violation of campaign finance laws because, the Russian woman was offering dirt on the Clintons, and Trump Jr. knew that and said, yeah, I'm happy to receive this. But then ultimately, Mueller says, well, I can't decide whether this violates the law because there's no precedent in case law in the United on campaign finance law to determine that opposition research from a foreigner would be considered a thing of value under campaign finance law. Mm-hmm. So it's this incredibly narrow conclusion that Mueller comes to avoid prosecuting Donald Trump Jr. or Manafort or Kushner on a conspiracy to violate the campaign finance laws, because there's no case law on the issue of does opposition research count as a thing of value under campaign finance laws. That is such an arcane, narrow basis for the decision that if you look at it, that's one of the key moments in the campaign And yet it's allowed the fact that Mueller refused to follow through and prosecute that has allowed Trump to go around saying there was no collusion, when in fact it was this very narrow legalistic decision by his office.
Well, just a few days ago at a function on Capitol Hill, I think it was, William Barr ran into Nancy Pelosi and rather smugly and arrogantly said in a loud voice so everybody could hear him, "Did you bring your handcuffs?"
Right.
And it seems like there is an arrogance and smugness to him, and a dismissal of the Democrats as an irritant. And it does seem like he's actually proud of the job he's done in covering up for Trump. So, you know, I've been trying to look into what went on prior to that four-page memo, and it's pretty hard to...
Yeah, I think that, you know, you had... Rosenstein had... And this is the key relationship that we don't understand completely, is the relationship between Rosenstein and Mueller. Because Rosenstein has said he had frequent confidential conversations with Mueller over the last couple of years about the investigation. He then, in the fall of 2018, tells Trump, pleads with Trump to let him keep doing it after the story about whether he would wear a wire to meet with Trump, because he says, I can make sure this is handled safely and securely for you by landing the plane. And so then Barr steps in at about that same time and becomes, you know, yet another force on behalf of Trump. So I think you had just enormous pressure building in the system. Plus, if you look at Mueller himself, and I point this out in my column, he's always been a very cautious guy. He was never the aggressive, zealot-like Starr or Walsh or anybody like that. So I just think you had a whole convergence of things that led to a narrow and hesitant report.
Well, I was trying to look into reports that in effect, Barr wore him down, Mueller, and that it even came to the point where Mueller was even suggesting that he might basically, you mentioned that the ruling about the Justice Department policy about not indicting a sitting president could be overturned. It's not in concrete. And maybe he was going to go ahead and indict, and which would then, under the rules, the same rules that say you can't indict a sitting president, he said if the Attorney General turns down any subpoena from the special counsel, that information has to go to the chairs of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, and that'd be a way of making it public. I don't know whether any of that's true, but my sense is that that's an area to really look into. What went on in that behind the scenes?
I agree with you. And, you know, you got to remember Barr got the job as Attorney General after he wrote a memo, public memo, basically an open letter to Trump saying there's no case for obstruction of justice here. And that was before he was even Attorney General. So he sold himself to Trump as the guy who could dismiss Mueller's arguments. And so I think there's no question that that's what he was doing. I guess my only question is, to what degree was Rosenstein his ally in that? And it seems like he was.
Well, just in closing, it's pretty clear to me, James Risen, that Trump understands public relations pretty well, because it's, you know, government by stunt, and he's a reality TV guy, and he keeps throwing us a bone every day, distracting us from the fact that he can't govern. And even his prior business career was all about chaos, and apparently he's continued that method of chaotic governance. But he does seem to understand how damaging the public testimony of Michael Cohen's was. And I'm sure that that's what's really going on here. He doesn't mind people saying stuff in depositions like Don McGahn, but he doesn't want Don McGahn to go public and explain what it's like. Right. And my understanding from trying to talk to people who've worked with Trump over the years and know him, that if you spend a few minutes with a guy, you realize he's totally nuts. And that if you could get a camera inside the Oval Office to see what this guy is like on a daily basis, he'd be finished in a heartbeat. So yeah. he got people like Cohen really get under his skin because they start to give the public a portrait of who this fellow is that's leading the country.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think you're right that having Cohen and then having Mueller testify would be devastating for him.
Right, and McGahn too, possibly. But that leads me to the basic question that's hanging now is what we're talking about, speculating about how much Barr might have worn down Mueller and sanitized the report. We'd only learn that if he were to testify, right? If Mueller were to testify.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's what it will, if he, I think he will ultimately testify. And I think what it will require is some real disciplined questioning by the Democrats in the House. They need to focus. One of the problems with congressional hearings often is that, you know, you get one senator or one House member, questions for 3 minutes, and then somebody moves on, and they lose the track of the conversation. I think it would be great if they could just have really well-informed staff members on the committees do the questioning, and because then you can follow the thread.
Sure, but that's what Barr, that's why he refused to testify to the House, because he didn't want to be asked by pros. So, and of course, if you have a Senate hearing, a lot of the Democratic senators are they're running for president like they were with Kavanaugh.
Right.
You know, they were auditioning.
Right.
So not a happy prospect. But let's stay in touch and stay tuned here. One can only hope that all of our speculation about Mueller, at least some of it, will be answered if he does, in fact, testify publicly.
Right, yeah, that'd be great.
Well, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Sure. Happy to do it. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of the New York Times bestseller State of War. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept, Did Donald Trump's Grip on the Justice Department Sabotage Robert Mueller's Investigation? We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the impact of Trump's executive order that effectively bars U.S. companies from using telecom equipment manufactured by China's Huawei. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gordon Chang, a writer and international policy analyst. He's the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. And he tweets at Gordon G. Chang. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Chang.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of the Trump administration pulling out its big guns on Wednesday with an executive order from Donald Trump basically initiating a two-pronged assault on China, barring companies that the U.S. considers a national security threat from selling to the U.S. and threatening to blacklist Huawei technologies from essentially preventing them from buying essential components here? You know, obviously they work in conjunction with Qualcomm and other big American companies. So the general impression is that it's going to really hurt Huawei. It may even slow down the release of 5G, but it also may hurt American companies. What do you make of it?
Well, right now, we have not just a trade war, but we have an all-encompassing economic struggle And the Chinese really have left us with very little choice. You know, we can't expect that we can run decades of misguided trade policy and get out of this unscathed. So there will be some harm to American companies, but we will be able to adjust. We'll survive this much better. And we've got to do something about China's theft of U.S. intellectual property and their quickly deteriorating trade behavior.
So is that to say then that pulling out of the TPP was a mistake?
I think pulling out of the TPP was a mistake. The United States had a perfect opportunity to build a big trading organization with the U.S. at the center. And I think that essentially right now, if you view China as our main adversary, which you should, I think that whatever deficiencies there were in the TPP agreement, Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think that they probably were not that important in the scheme of things.
Well, it would have organized the neighborhood and forced China to play by the rules. And I think it's pretty clear that since TPP collapsed, or since President Trump, one of his first moves was to pull out of it, you can see that China has moved away from what little democratic reform was underway, and that Uncle Xi, Xi Jinping, has made himself, you know, dictator for life.
Well, that would have happened anyway, Ian. You know, in terms of getting China to play by the rules, the Trans-Pacific Partnership would not have done that. First of all, you know, joining the World Trade Organization in 2001, that should have made China play by the rules. But, you know, we've seen under Xi Jinping, since he became General Party Secretary in November 2012, we've seen him actually start to close off the Chinese economy in ways which are really quite disturbing. And, of course, these are violations of China's WTO commitments, and we've seen them ramp up theft of U.S. intellectual property, forced taking. All sorts of really bad things have occurred. So, you know, although we should have been in TPP, and I didn't like the idea that President Trump withdrew from it, nonetheless, that's not going to have very much of an effect on the Chinese trade behavior, which was deteriorating anyway.
So how can you, though, to explain to our audience the contradictions in this relationship we have with China? You have the Chinese elite squirreling their money out, sending their kids over here for education. You have China buying our treasury bills, and as far as I know, they are still going to buy them. At the same time, you know, this escalating trade war, and now this, I think, the Huawei situation, I think, is the Chinese apparently are really upset by this. So you've got cooperation, if that's the right word, on the one hand, but you've got confrontation on the other.
Yeah, the confrontation is going to be the attribute that we're going to see much more of. And the reason is, you know, we've had decades of engagement of China, and it just hasn't worked. You know, we've tried all sorts of things in the trade area to get China to play by the rules. That haven't worked either. So I think the only thing that will actually protect the American economy, protect its business and workers, is actually just disengaging from China, getting our supply chains out of China, trading with our friends rather than a potential enemy. And we got to remember that as we have traded with China, they've used the proceeds to expand their military. Their senior military officers are more and more bold, talking about killing Americans and doing that in public. So, you know, this is a relationship which is just seriously wrong from our point of view, and we've got to adjust it. We need to trade with our friends, which is the reason why I think we should be in TPP, but we can make bilateral agreements with them. But in any event, we shouldn't be trading with a country that openly boasts about attacking us.
And again, I'm speaking with Gordon Cheng, a writer and international policy analyst. He's the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. And he tweets at Gordon G. Cheng. So in terms of Huawei, as you know, the daughter of the founder is under some kind of house arrest up in Vancouver. The U.S. wants her extradited here to the United States for breaking, I guess it was to do with illicit trade with Iran. But the father who founded the company, he was a senior member of the PLA, wasn't he? Don't they work in conjunction with the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, Huawei?
Yeah, well, Huawei says it is owned by employees. But if you look at it, it's actually state-owned with very little employee involvement. Maybe 1% of stock is employee-owned, and that is the founder. The founder was a colonel of in the PLA, People's Liberation Army, and they've maintained very close contacts. Huawei grew so fast, largely because it was supported by the Chinese central government and the Communist Party. Chinese diplomats around the world push Huawei's products into various countries. And so this really is China. And as a matter of fact, Huawei's name, it just literally translates for China. So that's really the reality of this. And essentially, we've got to understand that we're in a competition with China. And China is certainly not playing by the rules and is playing in ways which are extremely dangerous to not only us, but to our friends and allies, and indeed the whole concept of a international system.
What about this idea that, and I know it's often naively expressed, but the idea of how do you confront China in the sense that you don't want them to lose face? Is that a ruse that works in their favor, or are they genuinely offended when actions like what the president's just taken vis-a-vis Huawei happen? And are they likely to get kind of, you know, dig in?
Well, China's certainly likely to dig in, largely because the actions yesterday, the two you mentioned, President Trump's emergency order and the Commerce Department's adding Huawei to its list of designated entities, is almost a death sentence for Huawei. Not quite, but it would certainly be a death sentence for its cousin, ZTE, another Chinese telecom equipment manufacturer. So Beijing has no choice but to react to this, and we are going to see an escalating dispute. You know, the Chinese, of course, are concerned about face, but so are we. But saving Chinese face should not be a goal of American foreign policy. The goal of American foreign policy should be to protect the international system that we developed after the Second World War, and also to look out for American businesses and workers. And too often in the past, American foreign policy has put the interests of Chinese workers and businesses above our own. And what President Trump is doing, and I think probably Secretary Clinton would have done if she were elected in 2016, is actually readjusting American foreign policy so that it is much more focused on American interests.
So given that countries spy on each other and economic espionage goes on, I mean, America's one of its closest allies, Israel, is very much engaged in economic espionage. And we know that China is deep into it here. In, you know, for example, the OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, the Chinese basically got every bio on every federal employee, including all the people in the intelligence community. They hacked the whole thing. They've done some extraordinary hacking. So what do you do about that? In other words, if it's going on in the shadows, is it up to us to have better protection? I mean, we don't even have protection of our own electoral system, and the Russians hacked that in 2016. So who's to blame here? Should we really be focusing on our defenses and accept the fact that the Chinese are going to steal our technology? Or is there something else we can do? Can you actually make a deal that sticks? Because I believe Obama did make some kind of a deal early on when she first visited here. I think it was at Palm Springs, was it not?
There are a lot of issues there to unpack. First of all, the United States has not defended its networks, and that's on us. And for that, you can blame a number of presidents whose last names are Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And clearly, we need to do more. There's a couple of things here. Countries spy on each other. And one could argue that the cyber attack on the Office of Personnel Management, which you mentioned, is fair game. You know, it's the federal employees, intelligence community. That's one thing. The other thing, though, is cyber attacks and stealing of technology from companies for just commercial purposes. And President Obama and Xi Jinping of China, in September 2015, in the Rose Garden, came to an agreement where neither country would cyber attack the commercial enterprises of the others for commercial purposes, and that the Chinese have completely violated. I don't think any agreement can stick. The way do you get
China to stop stealing our intellectual property is to impose costs on China that are greater than the benefits they receive. That's not an easy task because China steals somewhere between $150 and $600 billion worth of U.S. IP a year, probably in the $300 to $400 billion range, but nobody knows. But the point is the costs have to be very high to get Beijing to stop what is criminal conduct.
So in a simplistic description then, our people here, our brilliant minds, they invent things, then China steals them and turns around and steals a march on manufacturing, whatever it is we invent. Is that how it works?
That's exactly how it works. And the United States is not going to have an economy of the future if we cannot commercialize our innovation, because increasingly our larger companies are innovation-based. And if you look at, for instance, the S&P 500, maybe 35, maybe 40% of those are tech companies. And that percentage is going up over time. So it's important to sell soybeans to China, but we don't want an agreement where we sell soybeans and we do nothing about IP theft, because IP theft really is at the core of the American economy and therefore at the core of American security and American society.
So what about the example of the iPhone then? It's often cited as, well, you know, it was made in China. Now, I understand that the Chinese version, which, you know, first of all, I believe that nationalism has come into play in China and they've discouraged people from buying Apples. It's not patriotic. And whatever the Chinese version is, people are buying. They did for a while. The iPhone was a real status symbol in China, my understanding is. But so just walk us through what happened there. Is it true that Apple were able to work out a system where they didn't lose their intellectual property and were able to make their phones in China, but at the same time, now it looks as if they're losing to Chinese competition?
Well, certainly Apple is losing to Chinese competition over time. And this is nothing to do with the Chinese central government or the Communist Party. It's just that Chinese phones are much better value than Apple's. So it's losing its allure. But put on top of that, you have the Chinese government attacking Apple in Cultural Revolution-style campaigns every once in a while. And they do that, of course, to cripple a foreign competitor. Apple is a company that could easily get hurt in this trade war. But Apple made a decision. They made a decision to base their production in China, and we should not hold American national security hostage to Apple's profits this quarter. Apple will be able to adjust. It's going to be one of the companies that's going to take the longest to adjust. They're going to, I think, bear more pain than most other companies. But that's a decision that Apple made. And, you know, as much as I'd like to help Apple, I'm much more concerned about the general health of the American economy and our future than I am about the fortunes of one particular company. Apple will sell more in India. They'll get production out of China, as other companies are doing right now. We had the announcement from Black & Decker yesterday about they're taking Craftsman tool production and moving it into Fort Worth, Texas. That's a great story. GoPro announced in December that it's reducing its reliance on Chinese factories in its supply chain. This is going to happen because it just makes sense right now.
Well, Gordon Chang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Gordon Chang, a writer and international policy analyst. He's the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. And he tweets at Gordon G. Chang. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.